it true. About all you have to do is all that running around gonna satisfy you. Why don't you take time? Oh yeah. You've gotta take time. What's the hurry? Where's the race? Do you really think that you can keep up this pace? Why don't you take time? Yeah. You've gotta take time. You've gotta take time. Unwind. Leave that grind in the way behind. You've gotta take time. Make space. Relax a while in your favorite place. You've gotta take time. It's a mess, you got an unmade bed. Will you always be a slave to staying ahead? Why don't you take time? Oh yeah. You've gotta take time. You got people to call, dishes in the sink. It's not as important as you seem to think. Why don't you take time? Oh yeah. You gotta take time. You gotta take time. Unwind. Leave that grind in the way behind. You gotta take time. Make space. Relax a while in your favorite place. You gotta take time. Whoa.
Hello, universe. Welcome to Live at Ordinary Miracles. My name is Matt Kramer. My co-host, Jan Sircone, is off in Egypt still. I think she'll still be in Egypt next week as well. When she does something, she does it deep. And you've been listening to the music of Al Haas, who's our guest tonight. I'm bringing Al on in about 5 minutes or so. And then I got to figure out what to say for the next 5 minutes as the leader of the ship this week. So, for those of you who've been listening before, thank you, welcome back. And for those of you that are new and say, what the heck is this show about? Well, my co-host and I both work in the field of sound and healing. And Jan Sircone does something called voice bio. And the process and the equipment she works with is able to listen to the frequencies in your voice. And if I can remember her correctly, if your voice is high or low in particular tones, that's a direct connection to aspects of your health that you can actually strengthen by toning the low tones or toning the opposite of the high tones, I think. So probably not being that good of a descriptor for her, but one thing you can do is go to Jan's website, which is musicforjoyandhealing.com, and look for voice bio on there. And then my piece of the pie is something called voice mapping. And if you've ever had deep tissue massage, rolfing, something like that, and all of a sudden you don't know why you're crying or laughing, it's because the practitioner hit a place where there's a connection between muscle and memory. And the muscles of your body from your pelvis through your skull all contribute to creating your voice. And so there's a memory impact. If you're thinking about something historically, it's a car wreck or your mom or something like that, then there'll be a particular image that comes up in the process called a voice map, which shows what emotions are connected to those memories. And to learn more about that, you can go to my website, mattkramer.com. And if you're looking at the screen, you'll see my name. And click on the banner on voice mapping. Next week, we're going to have Steve Seskin as our guest. Steve is a wonderful singer-songwriter. And if you haven't heard of Steve, you may have heard one of his songs called Don't Laugh at Me, which Peter, Paul, and Mary have turned into an anthem, kind of in the battle against bullies in our culture. And it's about what I can think of at the moment. And maybe it's time to bring Al on. And it's kind of ironic. I'm thinking here as I'm talking about these issues in alternative medicine. Al's a wonderful musician. You've been listening to his music. Al's also a doctor and works at Kaiser. And say hello, Al.
Hey there. How are you, Matt?
Okay. Anything come up for you as I was talking about those modalities?
Well, I was checking out my muscles, trying to figure out where I'm tense. And it sounds very intriguing, the voice mapping.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. What do you want people to know about you to start things off?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I think that the thing that draws me to songs as much as anything are the stories that they tell. And I think if there were a connection between what I really like about songs and what I really like about the work that I do, is hearing people's stories and trying to kind of get a sense of what's meaningful to each of us. Even in a brief interaction with patients in an allergy clinic, I often will get a really good sense of what's important to them and get a good story out of them. And songs, Lord knows, you know, there's just fabulous stories in songs.
So have you gotten some ideas and actually written songs as a consequence of your work in the medical profession?
Well, yeah, actually, I used to work just about two doors away from a couple of dietitians, and we would share, it's not exactly, you know, stories of the patients, but it's colleagues, and, you know, it's just some of the absurdity of, you know, what there is available and wonderfully delicious for us to eat on the one hand, and what's actually good for us and what's available, you know, yeah, what's good for us on the other hand. And so they were kind of the inspiration for the tune Just Like Your Disposal that I wrote. And I would say that you know, most of my songs, they hit me, you know, kind of when I'm bike riding or in some, you know, relatively quiet setting, and they tend not to have to do with the patient stories. kind of mysterious how they come about. I'm not one of those that sits down to write a song very often. It's the sort of thing that something just kind of comes to me, and I figure, hey, I gotta, you know, write this down. It's easier that way. That's
Now, the reason I asked you to come on the show is I know you as a singer-songwriter, and I've really enjoyed your music. You performed here at my place a couple of times. But it was a nice bonus to look at your bio and see that you're also very much into storytelling. And
oh,
I hope you're,
yeah,
you're open to telling stories tonight, because people love stories.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess I was kind of introduced to it with a group of doctors who were questioning their work in the field of medicine and how far they had gone astray from what they originally had wanted to do. And there were, you know, personal stories of how they wanted to recapture the inspiration that they felt when they first went into medicine, the notion of you know, being a true healer and also being able to be present for people and listen and to connect with patients. And in modern medicine, in the traditional setting, it's there's so many pressures that it's really hard to do that sometimes. And so we really needed to support each other. And so that's kind of how we started, is, you know, we would go out into nature. We would kind of tell stories, our personal stories, where we're at now and kind of what we're looking for the future. And then we'd go be alone in nature for a day or so. It might be 24 hours. And some of us would fast. All of us, at least, pretended to fast. I was one of those that had one of those energy bars or two, you know. And then we come back and we tell stories about kind of what we learned, and a lot of it was through nature. Nature's been around, you know, the trees and the mountains. They've been around for eons compared to us, and there's a certain wisdom sometimes that you can get from nature. So it was really neat to share the stories, and they were all so different, and they were all similar at the same time on some level. And so that was kind of my first story group, and then after that, I met some people that were into storytelling just for storytelling. And it was kind of neat, because then, you know, it kind of opened you up to telling all kinds of stories from all kinds of other people. But again, you get the sense that there's so much diversity among stories, and yet it's all part of the same fabric. And so from time to time, you know, I will go to people's houses where you know, we're just doing stories, usually around a fire, and we've hosted a number of them. And sometimes we'll have a theme, like, you know, the darkest day of the year. This last year, I went over to someone's house, and we all told stories of darkness. And we each had our stories in three sections. One was the beginning, one was the middle, one was the end. And each of us went around telling our beginnings,
mm-hmm,
one at a time. And then each of us told our middles one at a time. And then each of us told the end, which just served to emphasize, again, how it was all kind of woven together in this single fabric.
So it's like half a dozen chapter ones to be continued.
Right, exactly. So someone say, this is introduction, and okay, now I'm done with the first part, and the next person next to you would then go.
Well, can you remember your story?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a story. Well, you know, I am, in essence, a singer-songwriter, so
mm-hmm,
it all comes back to me eventually. But I wrote a story as if it were a fairy tale, and it had to do with what it would be like if I had been in a fairy tale. My life had been scripted as a fairy tale.
Are you going to tell the story now?
No, I'm not. I don't know your audience well enough, Matt. but anyway, I mean, and the idea was, it was supposed to depict somehow the very darkest time that you could remember.
Okay.
Or that you know, was accessible to you. And so, I heard, I mean, some of the people just brought in beautiful stories. And I'm completely captivated by it. I love it.
Well, do you remember a story you feel safe telling?
Oh, I remember a gal named Jane Doe.
Okay.
Who told the story of how this girl, having kind of two lives, and it started when she was a little girl and an old woman seemed like a witch, came up to knock on her window, or bedroom window, which was up on the second story, and beckoned her to come with her, and brought her down to a place below the earth. I think there was light. I don't believe there were any brooms or anything. There was certainly moonlight. She just did a beautiful job of describing the whole thing, and about how rich and yet scary this dark underworld was. And then later on brought her back, and how she lived for many years kind of in these two different worlds, one underneath the ground, which was dark and very scary, but also very beautiful and rich, and the other one where she was kind of, you know, an upstanding, well-spoken, accomplished, appealing person, but it was only a part of her. She wasn't able to really integrate the two parts of herself. And then she talked about how eventually she was able to do that. So that's, you know, that's the gist of the story. What I can't recapture is, you know, just the beautiful imagery that she had, and of course, you know, it was very dark that night, and we had candlelight, so yeah, it was enjoyable.
And this was kind of like a therapeutic support group for doctors.
Yes, well, this one wasn't doctors. This was actually a group of people mostly connected with hospice.
Okay.
But that's right. I mean, I really think of the first group as a support group for a certain kind of doctor that isn't necessarily supported in the current medical institutions.
You know, something that's come up in my work is who takes care of the caretakers.
Absolutely. Caretakers in general are often reluctant to seek care, and they're much more comfortable taking care of other people than being taken care of. I should say we rather than they, because that certainly applies to me. And sometimes, as was the case for me, it has to become painfully obvious that you need help before you go get it. And you know, I had that experience about 8 years ago where, you know, it wasn't working. The way that I was working and taking care of others without really taking care of myself and nourishing myself in a soulful way, it pretty much stopped me in my tracks. And it was a gradual learning process about what really nourishes me, and what in work really nourishes me, and what in work do I want to let go of that isn't really me, it's somebody else wanting me to be a certain way.
So if you were talking to a young doctor just starting out, who just came out of medical school, and that's sort of a grinding routine, as I understand it.
Oh, absolutely.
What would you tell that doctor?
Well, I tell a doctor something that I heard from another doctor myself, and that is, you know, you're taking care of patients, some of whom are very critically ill. You want to nurture the attitude that you as a physician are, in fact, your own most critically ill patient. And that is, of course, a vast overstatement. On the other hand, it takes a vast overstatement in general for many physicians to allow themselves the smallest of luxuries of taking time. You know, that's really, that song that played at the beginning of this was really me lecturing to myself about how, you know, don't get caught up in these day-to-day responsibilities. Ain't nothing more important than you know, enjoying the gift that this life is at some point in the day. And it's a gradual process.
Actually, I had a conversation earlier this evening with a man who's a director of a local nonprofit that provides services for domestic workers who get very little representation in our culture.
Yeah.
And this guy works himself to death. And I said, you ought to get a massage. He's never had a massage in his life.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, if you don't take care of yourself, you're not going to have a lot to help take care of the folks you're trying to help.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting. I recently had heard some doctors give some very inspiring talks on service and improving service to members, because that's a big deal. I mean, it's kind of a corporate imperative, because that's the, you know, it serves a certain purpose for a corporation like Kaiser. It also can be very satisfying for providers. But this one particular emergency doctor who gave a talk on service, he started it by saying, you know, when you are in the middle of your busy day, stop for a second and rate it. Rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. And then ask yourself, you know, if you rated it low, a 2 or a 3, and you're expecting yourself to deliver service that a patient would rate as a 9 or a 10, you got to wonder, how is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
And so he started his service talk with, you know, you got to be sure that you take care of yourself, number one. And, you know, he started at the beginning because it really, I think it, that's the way the priority should be. It usually isn't. And then he ended it in a way that really spoke to me, which is that to serve other people is a very high calling. And there's a spiritual calling to it. And that's true if it's in the right context. If, on the other hand, you work yourself to, an absolute wreck in the process of helping other people, quote-unquote, thrive, you're being a hypocrite, you know? So it's good for you, but it's no good for me. Yes, it's been a learning process, and I would say a lot of people in the helping profession are really in that same situation.
Yeah, a lot of adrenal burnout.
Yes, right. Okay. And then, you know, then there are other people for whom it just doesn't make any sense to push themselves out that much. My wife is an artist, and one of the things that attracted me to her is she really had a whole other take on you know, how you relate in the world. And when she sees an opportunity to enjoy herself or to express beauty or to appreciate beauty, she grabs it. And I always thought, that is cool.
Would you say that she's better at being in the moment?
Absolutely. Sometimes, you know, it frustrates me, and I'll tell her, hey, look at all the things that there are to do. How can you just sit around like that? And then I catch myself thinking, wait a minute, do I want her to be more like me, or do I want me to be more like her?
Uh-huh.
And And I have really, you know, I've really learned much more, I believe, from her than she has from me along those lines. And I've really sort of developed the inner Katie, is her name.
Uh-huh.
I have my inner Katie that's it's being nurtured on a regular basis. Because it doesn't come as naturally to me.
All right. So let me ask you, what came first, with medicine or music?
Oh, music. Music came first. It came while I was horseback riding at a dude ranch. I was probably 6 or 7. I had just learned to whistle. And I had heard a tune that I thought was just wonderful. And it was called Red River Valley. And
I remember that song.
You remember that song. And I started whistling as I was riding on my horse. And I thought, you know, this was living. And I would always sing. I don't know, as a kid, it just made me feel good. And you know, I picked up guitar in high school, and when I went to college, I had no idea what I was going to be, and my college counselor said, is there any chance you might want to be a doctor? And I said, no way. He said, good, because if you did, we'd have to start planning now. I said, don't worry. So you never know. I was an English major when I started. Again, I mean, it was the stories that just completely drew me. I thought, geez, I'm going to learn about life in college. This is exciting. And I took some philosophy classes, and philosophy just left me so cold because it seemed like it was processed from the real organic stories of people. And so I kind of, you know, on the one hand, the philosophy left me cold. On the other hand, I found most of the wisdom that I was looking for was in books, in stories, in English literature.
So how did you get from no way to getting into medicine?
Well, I was watching what was happening to the English majors, and a lot of them were ending up as stockbrokers, and I was pretty sure I didn't want to do that. And some of them, of course, were, you know, getting professorships in Ohio somewhere and stuff like that. I guess I just had this real practical part of me that wanted to be able to provide a useful skill to other people, and I just didn't, I don't know, I just wanted something concrete. And so I remember going up on the top of Mount Tam at one point in crisis, you know, I was a junior. I was thinking, geez, I'm going to graduate in a year and a half. And I knew that medicine had occurred to me as something that I might want to do, but I sure didn't like the way doctors practice medicine. I couldn't identify with the doctors that I knew. But but I knew that, you know, where I came from was kind of this hippie, beautiful person image. I wanted to be a hippie doctor. I wanted to be in a Volkswagen bus. I wanted to have all my medicines in the van, and I would go around to wherever I was needed, and I would provide medical services.
I think there's a future in that.
Well, that's right. Exactly. And so I just thought, you know what? I can do it the way that I want to do it. And even though I work out of an office and I have exam rooms, I think I'm remarkably close to what I had imagined, in that I am, I believe, one of the most accessible doctors at Kaiser, and have all kinds of ways that patients can contact me now with email or telephone. I spend a lot of time on the telephone with patients. Allergy, you can do that. Surgery, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Allergy, again, the stories are everything. A dermatologist will listen to a story and say, nah, you're wrong. Look at the rash and say, this has been here for this long. But me, the allergist, it's all the history is what they call it. It's all the story. And so people, before I finished up at work today, I was talking to a patient patient's mother, who has had a variety of rashes, and I can diagnose a lot of allergic conditions, hive rashes. I talk to people a lot about by the nature of how the rash comes and goes and that sort of thing, and make recommendations, sometimes order tests, and they do it in the comfort of their own home and don't have to drive on Highway 101, don't have to look for a parking spot in our increasingly crowded parking lot. So I get a lot of satisfaction in a funny way, similar to the image that I had up on the top of Mount Tam when I was trying to figure out, where is my place in the world? I knew I wasn't talented enough to make a living at music, and I think to me it was really important to be able to support a family,
mm-hmm.
and so it was a calculated decision.
I'm imagining like the TV show MASH. Are you like the Hawkeye of Kaiser?
I didn't watch MASH.
Okay.
So I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Knows about these sort of rebellious individualists amidst the army machinery.
I'm definitely different.
my
fellow allergists, from around the region, they kind of shake their head. But the powers that be higher up are very intrigued because the old way of doing medicine, it may not be around for a whole lot longer. People can't afford it.
So what's going to happen?
Well, I'm afraid what's going to happen. I think that we in America have a kind of a product orientation as opposed to a people orientation. And there are an ever-expanding array of products in medicine, and they go by the name of pharmaceuticals,
mm-hmm.
machines, and then the more complicated the machines get, the more highly trained personnel you have to run them. 30 years ago, if someone had chest pain, their doctor would give them nitroglycerin and say, see if this helps, and they came back and they said it helps, and you say, you have angina. Now there's a echocardiogram, there's a stress echocardiogram, there's an angiogram, there's a million different procedures that you can do that you couldn't do then. And so we have all these products that didn't exist before, and they're multiplying exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
And as the cost for those things goes up, we find it harder and harder to afford health care. And what's getting squeezed out now is time face to face.
I'm tempted to bring in my world to a sense. My wife is a naturopath. And do you know how a naturopath works differently than Western MD?
Vaguely. Tell me about it.
And the question is, how vague is my understanding? But that the body has many resources for healing itself, and that also there are different aspects of the body at play where you might see a surface symptom, but the solution is somewhere else. For example, a dermatologist, I guess, may work on how do we heal the skin, whereas my wife will look at a case of acne and say, well, let's look at healing the liver, because there's some challenges the liver's having with detoxification, and that's why there's an improper detox pathway affecting the skin.
Yeah.
So that's just one little piece of the vast knowledge that she has.
Yes, yes. Well, let me tell you this. I'm convinced that, in general, there's a lot more that we don't know than that we know.
And how many doctors are willing to say that?
I don't know, but I think we all have a very strong sense of that. And for some of us, it puts us in a panic, and we make things up, you know, as we go. And for some of us, it's like, this isn't a surprise, you know. And it's almost as it should be, that there should be some mysteries. I don't think we'll ever have to worry about solving all the mysteries.
Oh, I remember somebody showed me once that you draw a small circle when you're young, and that represents what you know. And the circumference of the circle is the beginning of what you know you don't know.
Ah, yes.
So as you learn more, that circle gets bigger.
Yeah.
And therefore, the circumference of what you know you don't know gets bigger.
Yeah, that's a beautiful image. And I think that, in a doctor's career, often it works just that way, that someone just out of residency has a lot of confidence that their sphere of knowledge is fairly broad, and as the career goes on, they become more and more aware of what they don't know, and hopefully more and more comfortable with what they don't know.
Right.
And I can't tell you how many times in a week I will. I mean, it's a few times every week I'll say to a patient, wow, I've never heard that one before.
Mm.
And I know that that doesn't inspire confidence in a patient. On the other hand, I believe it inspires trust.
Yes.
Because that sounds believable.
And you say, let's see what we can do in this project.
Exactly. Let's do the best that we can, and we'll put our heads together. And that's one of the biggest, I could say, it's really initiated by patients. Is, you know, in the olden days, there was the idea that the doctor told you what to do and you did it,
mm-hmm.
or you didn't do it, but you certainly didn't question the doctor.
Right.
And more now, doctors are very receptive and even encouraging of patients to work with the doctor to try to figure out what's the best. And, you know, I mean, it's never going to work unless you do that anyway.
Well, I think to any doctor's advantage is to say to the patient, there's nobody like you.
Absolutely.
Each of us is truly unique.
That's right. That's right.
And, of course, part of what my wife's practice is to educate people to better understand their own metabolism, their own health history.
Right.
And
even if the process is similar, the meaning to the patient is unique. How it affects them in their life, what the various options might look like for them. In the olden days, if someone was allergic to animals, the allergist had one thing to say, which is get rid of the animals. And that just doesn't make any sense. To me, for most people who've had pets for a number of years and they're allergic, and they love the animals often more than they love their family. Maybe some family members, anyway.
Well, animals are often better listeners.
Yes, that's right, exactly. And so, you better give them, the whole menu of options and help them decide what makes the most sense for them. They need to know, what the consequences are and what all the various options are. But I have patients who are on shots for dog and cat dander.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and then some people, I tell people to start with, you know, do not let the cat sleep on your face. and usually they go, ha, ha, ha. But sometimes they'll go, okay. So it really, you know, is a whole array of things. But you just want to, like I say, you know, from my point of view, you want to work together. It's a partnership. You want to work together with a patient and try to figure out, help them figure out what makes the best sense for them.
Now, one way I've had it explained to me is that it's what we call an allergy is really a challenge to the immune system.
Yes.
If we can uncover the weakness in the immune system and deal with healing that, then the allergy goes away.
Absolutely. And I want you to do that, Matt. I'd like for you to uncover it. Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was taught 20-plus years ago by, you know, one of the grandfathers of allergy, and he decided, you know, when he got out of training in the early 60s, that he wasn't going to go into allergy because they'd already identified what the antibody was that caused the whole problem, IgE, and it was just a matter of time before they figured out how to eliminate it, and there wouldn't be allergy anymore.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure it is a matter of time, but it's got to be, you know, we're looking at 50 years later, you know, 40 years.
But he was lumping all allergies into one solution?
What's that?
He was lumping all allergies into one possible solution?
Well, you know, it depends on how you define allergy, but you know, certainly hay fever, asthma, food allergies, eczema. If there were no IgE, none of this, which is immunoglobulin E, it's an antibody that we don't really know if it's necessary anymore. It certainly was at one time because it was very instrumental in helping us fight off parasitic infections.
You're talking about thousands of years ago.
Well, actually, currently in some underdeveloped parts of the world,
mm-hmm.
in Africa, that limb of the immune system is very active. And interestingly, there are no allergies there. So, and same with Mexico. Mexico, you know, there's a lot more exposure to parasitic infections and bacterial infections. And there's something called the hygiene hypothesis that in areas where there's very little exposure to parasites, very little exposure to bacterial infections, that somehow this leaves a limb of the immune system with no place to direct its energy.
No way to grow.
And it tends to then react to things like pollens and animals as if they were parasites.
That's very interesting.
And so, yeah, in fact, in farming communities where there's exposure to a lot of bacterial antigen in, you know, chicken manure and cow manure and stuff like that, allergy is very uncommon. It's much more uncommon.
Okay, I'm thinking of, you know, the ancient Aztec plumbing systems that are, I think, still in place. There's some very old amoebas down there.
Yeah,
I have met them.
You have?
Yes.
Oh, that sounds colorful, Matt.
Yes, that was another story. We haven't played any of your music yet, and I think we had a couple of songs picked out.
Yes, I kind of like, you know, the Disposal song that my friends down the hall inspired. I remember, you know, shortly after it kind of came to me, like songs often will do, I played it for them, and I just wanted to be sure it was dietetically correct.
Uh-huh.
And they assured me that although it wasn't completely dietetically correct, it was poetically correct. So
the heart was there.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, the challenge here is that Seth, our master engineer, has to monitor about 5 BBS radio stations.
Whoa.
So, Seth, if you're listening, can we roll the Disposal song? And feel free to come on the air and tell me you heard me. And
not now.
I don't know. If we're silent, we have some dead air. Maybe you'll notice the dead air. Calling all Seth. We'll try it again in a bit.
Okay.
Are there any stories you wanted to tell tonight?
Well, I did want to mention another song that I'd like to play, and there's kind of an interesting story behind it. It's the one song that I co-wrote of the songs that I gave Seth, and I co-wrote it with my mother. And
wow.
I bet there aren't a whole lot of people who write songs with their mothers, but
Hoyt Axton.
Is that right?
Well, Hoyt Axton's mom was a co-writer on Jailhouse Rock.
Is that right?
Yeah. It goes back a ways.
That is wonderful. Anyway, my mother, she wrote a poem, and it was called Pause, Swift Ocean. And I was very moved by it, and for her 80th birthday, I set it to music and recorded it.
Mm.
And my wife and I performed it. She sings, and then we gave the recording to her.
And what did your mother do?
Huh?
And what did your mother do?
Oh, well, she loved it. She just beamed. You know, my son at that point had started playing guitar, and he played guitar for her at the dinner, and she just looked, you know, like royalty. You know,
yep.
She was the center of attention, which she doesn't get to be all that often. And she was very, very happy with it. And she's coming down, actually, from Portland, where she lives. And yeah, I just thought for Mother's Day it would be kind of an interesting little story to tell. She, you know, her mother was like, well, and not all mothers were really, should have been mothers, perhaps. And, you know, my grandmother was very much involved in theater before she got married, and she loved having the spotlight on her, and was very self-centered as a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard for a kid, hard for a daughter. And her relationship with her own mother was very strained. And and I was moved by this particular poem that she wrote to the ocean. And the ocean being what she considered her real mother. And thinking, you know, will I be accepted by you, the ocean, will it be when I die eventually that, you know, that you take me back, that you accept me? And I also feel this enormous connection with nature, and the feeling that nature is the source, and that it's the mother of us all, and so I'm particularly fond of that one.
All right, let's see if Seth can hear us yet. Seth, if you're standing by, come on and play some music.
Not there.
Yeah, we'll probably, we can do is close out the show with the two songs, or at least one of them, because he will be listening towards the end of the show to make sure we make
yeah,
it on time.
Yeah, I got it. Yeah, the other thing that happened to me, as I was, you know, going through college, trying to figure out what I wanted to do and what was going to happen, become of me as an English major, I would do anything but study chemistry. I hated
mm-hmm.
chemistry. It was painful. And you had to do that to go to medical school. And And, you know, I ended up with I didn't have the grades to get into medical school. And so I had to figure out, you know, was I gonna give it up? I applied to, you know, you could apply to 20 medical schools back then. I don't know if you could, probably still can. And I did, and I got rejected everywhere. I got one interview, and they said no. And what I did is started looking into other countries, and there were people going to Mexico. That didn't look like fun at all. It was expensive. Another option was to go to France, but in France, they would accept many people, but then they would flunk out most of the Americans and only take a small quota after they had studied for a year or two. That didn't sound very appealing. But in Italy, it was, as Goldilocks would say, just right.
Okay.
It cost $75 a year to go there.
Are you serious?
And you couldn't flunk out. You could take 12 years to finish your degree.
$75 a year to go to medical school.
That's what I paid. And I got one of the cheapest medical educations anyone got back then, you know, and certainly by today's standards, it was ridiculously cheap. But that when it came to me that, you know what, not only do I have a way of becoming a doctor, but I have a way to get to Europe. I'd never been to Europe.
Uh-huh.
And just the idea of going to medical school and having an adventure at the same time, it was thrilling. And so, of course, I brought my guitar with me. I learned Italian at a university for foreigners. I spent 3 months there before medical school. And the Italians loved American music, Bob
mm-hmm.
Dylan in particular. And I knew tons of Bob Dylan songs. So I would go up to the piazza, and I would play Bob Dylan songs for them, and they would play the Italian songs for me. And so I learned some of the Italian songs. And I tell you, you know, music definitely helped me get through there.
I'm surprised you didn't wind up with an Italian wife.
Well, yeah, right. Well, Italian women are fabulous. You know, they're extremely volatile. If if you can excuse me stereotyping. But that's one of the things I love about the Italian people is they're emotional, and they're out there with their emotions. And yeah, the irony is I ended up with marrying someone who was probably, you know, a mile away from me when she was born. She was born in San Francisco. I was living in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
I'm 5 years older than she is, and she had lived in Israel for 5 years, and so she was back when I came back to the States. She was back from Israel, and so, you know, I kind of married the girl next door.
Now I have a question, because I have a friend who was a pediatric surgeon in Peru, and she went through hell getting approved to work in the United States, and she had to let go of the specialty and become a pediatrician as a way to be a little more accepted.
Well, that can happen. I think that the really fortunate thing for me is I was able to transfer into the third year of an American medical school at UC San Francisco.
And by then you had the grades.
Oh, yeah. And actually, it was all about taking the standardized tests called the national boards. And I knew when I went to Italy that this was going to be the criteria I'd be judged on. The grades in Italy were kind of hard for them to interpret, but the standardized test, I ended up, you know, scoring in the 90th percentile compared with other medical students in the States. And so that was my ticket to get back.
Very well done.
In wrestling, if you are about to be pinned and you make some kind of a move and you pin the opponent, someone's going to know more about that. If I remember, I think you get 3 points for that. It's like and that's the way it felt. It's like rejected in America, and then to end up back in an American school with an experience in Italy, it was like this complete reversal. And yeah, I felt very lucky.
Now, where did you start working as a doctor?
What's that? Where?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I ended up at UC San Francisco for medical school, and then I figured, you know, I really enjoyed pediatrics, and I did a pediatric residency training at UC San Francisco, and I had met my wife by that time, and I decided, geez, you know, we really like Sonoma County a lot. We like Napa County, and that's the area we'd really like to live. And I told that to one of the professors, and she said, you know what, if you want to live in that area, you should get some allergy training, because everyone has allergies in Sonoma County. And
yep.
So I started looking into allergy training, and I ended up doing a fellowship down at UCLA. And then I was going to join a group of pediatricians in Marin, is where it turned out, you know, there was an opening and I knew the people, and it fell through at the end. And then I started looking into different practices and actually applied to Kaiser Santa Rosa to be either an allergist or a pediatrician. And there happened to be an opening for an allergist, and I took it.
What years were you at UCLA?
Let's see, I was there 80... 84 to 88.
Did you ever
were down in Los Angeles, weren't you?
Did you ever have a nightclub called At My Place?
I heard of it.
That was my club.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I loved Los Angeles back then, being, you know, without kids, and I loved the music scene. I would go to McCabe's.
Yep.
I used to work there too. Spot, and I also remember the Mark Taper Forum had fabulous theater,
right?
Much better than San Francisco, I think, you know, in my humble opinion. And Mark Taper Forum was this theater in the round, and very intimate setting and fabulous actors coming to do stuff. So, yeah, we had a great time there. And that's where my wife went to art school, actually. But At My Place, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure you have a lot of stories, Matt.
Well, I have a little story about the med school at UC San Francisco.
What's that?
You said you went to UCSF?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to tell a story about a friend of mine who shall remain nameless.
John Doe.
Not Jane Doe.
Jane Doe.
Or Janice Doe.
Okay.
She was a friend of mine from L.A., and she was in her first year of med school up there at UCSF, invited me to come by, and she snuck me into the cadaver room.
Ah!
And so that we could... And at one point, she showed me one person that I could actually lift off the abdominal cavity and the chest cover.
Yeah.
But she was so new to it, and she was there with her younger sister, that she was like squealing and ew.
Yeah.
But she's now a very accomplished pediatrician. You know, she went through it. But I just remember that in her first year, she was like,
yeah,
how can you touch that?
So, Matt, how was that for you?
Intriguing. To in terms of the visceral realization of that's what's there.
Yeah.
Within all of us.
Yeah.
I'm realizing it's about 2 minutes to ten.
Yeah.
Seth, are you listening? we're going to suddenly wrap up the show. I just got a little education on radio protocol. We're going to want to thank you, Al, for being on our show.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we're going to go out with the song you co-wrote with your mom, Pause, Swift Ocean.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Pause, swift ocean, bring me solace, strength and grandeur, threaten me. If you really are my mother, sing to me a melody. Soon to you I'll be returning, when my earthly form has passed, mountain seashore far behind me, will you welcome me at last? Soon to you I'll be returning, when my earthly form has passed, mountain seashore far behind me, will you welcome me at last?